our study of this gospel, we have often seen Jesus engage in conflict with the Pharisees. Here in Luke 20, he also faced off against the highest religious leaders in Judaism, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. And then against the Herodians, and finally against the Sadducees. As this chapter closes, Jesus focused on the scribes alone. Now, often through this gospel, the scribes have been lumped in with the Pharisees. We find the phrase scribes and Pharisees nearly 20 times in the Gospels and in Acts. The scribes often agreed with the teaching of the Pharisees, and they helped to popularize the doctrines of the Pharisees when they taught in the synagogues. But the scribes were not a denomination within Judaism like the Pharisees. A scribe was a certain position within Judaism, a position that had existed for hundreds of years at this point. The first responsibility of the scribes was to copy the manuscripts of the Old Testament books. They literally were scribes. They did their work by writing, by copying texts. They were the first copy machines. They just didn't work for Xerox. Their methods of copying text were so meticulous that they counted every letter. And then they compared the total number of letters in the document they had copied to the document that they had copied from. And if the numbers didn't match, they burned the copy. No going back and scratching out letters. Their methods ensured that no words were left out and no words were introduced into the text. And their care with the physical copies of the books of the Old Testament is one of the reasons that you and I have a very faithfully preserved Old Testament. So I want to begin this morning by praising the scribes for the work that they did. Unfortunately, the scribes did not take the same care with the meaning of these Old Testament texts. Their other responsibility, the responsibility that comes to the forefront in the New Testament, was to read the Torah, the law of Moses, and then to teach based on the Torah in the synagogues. And therefore, they developed their own system of interpretation, oral tradition. Their intention was to create a hedge around the law of Moses so that it would be difficult for a Jew to break the law of Moses. But what they ended up doing was basically replacing the true meaning of God's law with their own traditions. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus repeatedly said, "You have heard it said, but I say unto you." When Jesus said, "But you have heard it said," it was said by the scribes, the rabbis. That is what he was denouncing in the first third of the Sermon on the Mount. And in the passage before us this morning, Jesus wanted to ensure that the Jewish people understood that they must not follow the errors of these scribes, either in their doctrine or in their practice. So let's pick up the story here in Luke 20 at verse 39. Luke 20 and verse 39. Then some of the scribes answered and said, "Teacher, you have spoken well." But after that, they dared not question him anymore. And he said to them, "How can they say that the Christ is the son of David? Now David himself said in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Therefore, David calls him Lord. How is he then his son? Then, in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, beware of the scribes who desire to go around in long robes, who love greetings in the marketplace, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation. And then here's another chapter break that's in the wrong place. Let's keep reading. And he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw also a poor widow putting in two mites. So he said, truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all. For all these out of their abundance have put in offerings for God, but she out of her poverty put in all the livelihood that she had. Now, if you recall the stories that we covered last week, according to verse 39, the scribes liked it when Jesus defeated the Sadducees, when he proved to them from the Torah the bodily resurrection. And so they verbally patted Jesus on the back, but Jesus was having none of it. He left no doubt that he had nothing to do with these supposed teachers of the law and their scribal errors. And here in this passage, his critique, his criticism of the scribes was twofold. First of all, in verses 41 through 44, he focused on their theology. He demonstrated that they didn't even understand the Messiah. Their teaching, their doctrine could not be trusted. Then second, Jesus focused on their practice. And he focused on their practice by means of a contrast. In verses 45 through 47, he focused on their empty religion, on their fear of man. We'll talk more about that. And he contrasted that with a widow woman that he saw there in the temple and the true self-sacrifice of that widow woman, a dramatic contrast. Now, to begin with, in verses 41 through 44, Jesus demonstrated how untrustworthy these teachers were by posing a conundrum. I like that word. How many of you know what a conundrum is? We got a librarian back here. What's it mean, Daniel? Daniel says he didn't bring his dictionary. It's a puzzle, an enigma, a paradox. And so Jesus presented these teachers with a theological puzzle from Psalm 110. Now you have to remember, these scribes were the experts on the law. In some texts in the Gospels, they're called lawyers. But this isn't the kind of lawyer that Al is. Okay? These were lawyers that were experts in the Old Testament law of Moses. Many of them were rabbis. We don't really connect with the word scribes today, but we do tend to connect with the word rabbi. Many of these scribes were rabbis. To put it in terms of our religion today, they were theologians. They were pastors. They were teachers. And in particular, these were the teachers that formed the conception that most of the Jews in that day had of the Messiah. That the Messiah was going to be a descendant of King David, and he was going to come and take political power and overthrow the Romans. Now, we saw several weeks ago that Jesus very purposely, very publicly claimed the office of Messiah. He didn't do it in so many words. He did it by his actions, through the triumphal entry, through the cleansing of the temple, through his teaching in the temple. He made clear that he was the Messiah, but he was not the kind of Messiah that these rabbis and scribes were describing to the people of Israel. And so it makes sense that Jesus would challenge these teachers, that he would challenge their conception of the Messiah, that he would make clear to the Jews, to the common Jews, that these rabbis didn't really even understand what the Old Testament had to say about the Messiah. And he did this by placing before these scribes a conundrum, a theological puzzle based on Psalm 110. So here in verse 41, Jesus stated the first premise of this puzzle, and that is that the Messiah, the Christ, remember both those words mean the same thing, the Messiah, the Christ, is the son of David. That is, the Messiah would be a descendant of David in the lineage of David, and therefore he would have the right to sit on the throne of David as his direct descendant. Remember, we talked about this a week or two ago. In Israel, genealogy was everything. The right to property was based directly on family lineage. And a Jew who could not trace his family line back to David and prove that by documentation need not apply to be the Messiah. Now, nobody disputed this truth. Jesus didn't dispute this truth. The Messiah was indeed the son of David. But then, according to verses 42 through 44, Jesus implied the second premise of this puzzle. In Psalm 110, David described this Messiah. Now, I wish we were having a second service today, because we would go back and we would read that entire psalm, and you would see that that psalm describes a warrior king. And it describes a warrior king who will ultimately be triumphant. Now, here's the problem. After King David, we don't really have any king in the history of Israel or Judah that fits the bill. But if you want to talk about a king who would come and sweep away the Romans, here we go. Psalm 110 is the perfect description of this. And so Jesus basically says to these scribes, look, if this is what you think the Messiah looks like, here he is described in Psalm 110. But then he says, look at the first phrase of this psalm. The Lord said to my Lord. Here we go. Everybody take your finger. Scratch your head. What's Jesus talking about here? What did David mean? Well, the Lord at the beginning of that is talking about God. Okay? So in this psalm, God is talking to this warrior king. He's talking to this Messiah. And David calls this Messiah what? My Lord. So in this psalm, God is talking to the Messiah who is David's Lord. Now, you need to understand that this would not have made sense to people in that day. Because the common idea was that if someone was my descendant, If one was my son or my grandson or my great-grandson, then they were of lower rank than I was. I was above them. I'm their forefather. That's how the Jews conceived of things. So this Messiah, being the son of David, would be someone of lower station. But then you flip this around. If David calls this person Lord, that title Lord implies what? It implies someone of higher station. And so Jesus poses the question to these scribes, how can this Messiah be both a son of David of lower station, and yet David calls him his Lord, so he is of higher station? Now here's the thing. Jesus didn't answer this question. Remember what we talked about last week? Sometimes the best way to get people to really consider a spiritual truth is to ask them a question, not to give them the answer. And so Jesus poses the question here, and it looks to me like the scribes are speechless. They have no answer, but Jesus doesn't give them the answer. He leaves them pondering, and I believe he left his own disciples pondering. He left the crowd there that day pondering. What's the solution to this puzzle? Now, what's interesting is that Luke, a couple of chapters later, does indeed give us the solution to this conundrum. So turn over a page or two to Luke 22. And here we find the trial of Jesus. And at one point here, getting close to the end of the trial, look with me in verse 67, Luke 22, 67. Members of the Sanhedrin say, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But Jesus said to them, "If I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." Remember, that's what Psalm 110 said about the Messiah. Then they all said to him, "Are you then the Son of God?" So he said to them, "You rightly say that I am." And they said, "What further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." Jesus was indeed the king described in Psalm 110, who would sit at the right hand of God. He was indeed the Messiah described there. And what is the solution to the conundrum? Jesus has two natures. He is 100% human, and he's 100% God. In that human nature, Jesus was the Son of David. He was David's descendant. But in Jesus' divine nature, in his deity, he was David's Lord and God. And so Jesus, in this conundrum, was actually laying out for his disciples to consider one of the great theological truths of our Christian faith, and that is that Jesus is man, 100% man, and yet God, 100% God. God said to this Messiah, God said to David said, God said to him, you are my Lord and my God. Jesus left not just the scribes, but his disciples and everyone that was in that crowd that day to ponder that great truth. Then in verse 45, Jesus immediately turned from these theological deficiencies to the practical deficiencies of these scribes. There were problems not only with what they taught, but also with how they lived. Verse 45 makes clear that Jesus spoke this warning to his own disciples, but in the hearing of all the people, and that included, of course, the scribes. So Jesus warned all of them of the practices of the scribes. Now, before we move on, I want you to see the connection between the two main points of my outline today. In Scripture, there is always a link, there is always a connection between what a preacher or a teacher or a pastor communicates with his mouth and the way that man lives his life. The New Testament again and again makes this connection. If a man's lifestyle is off, if the way he lives is not right, then what do you expect of his teaching? His teaching is not to be trusted. Now, I'm sure there are exceptions to this rule, but this is the rule. This is why in the pastoral epistles, when you find the qualifications for elders, it isn't just about the doctrine that they teach, it's also about the life that they live. And this is why it's so troubling when we see men in the pulpit fall into immorality and into lifestyle problems, because Scripture teaches us that we should not trust their teaching if we cannot trust their living. And so Christ is giving us that connection here in the text. Now, Jesus described the practice of the scribes in a handful of brief statements here in verses 46 and 47. First of all, they loved recognition. They wanted the applause of men. And specifically, Jesus gave two examples here. First, in verse 46, he says they went around in long robes. And the idea here is that a scribe wore a very fancy robe with a long mantle that reached to his feet. It was decorated with fringe. I can't even think of a modern example of dress that's a parallel to this. But the point is that scribes wore, they wore clothing that called attention to themselves. Their clothing screamed, look at me, I am a big something. The only thing that puts me in mind of this today is when I see some of these young evangelical preachers whose arms are filled with tattoos. And I'm thinking, what are you saying? It's the same thing. Look at me. Look at me. Am I not cool? Now, maybe it's just because I'm 62 and I think tattoos are hideous. I think there's going to be a new cottage industry in about 10 years. Have I told you this? You aren't going to see tattoo parlors anymore. You're going to see tattoo removal parlors. Because all these people are going to get these tattoos removed. Now, don't hold me to that. I'm not a prophet or the son of a prophet, but I just can't think that some of these people, when they get to be my age, are not going to be shaking their heads saying, why in the world did I ever do this to my body? That's free. You know, you don't have to pay for that. But that's the idea. They wanted to draw attention to their appearance. They wanted people to think they were really something because of the way they dressed. And then Jesus' second example of this desire for recognition pointed up greetings in the marketplace. Now, this was a thing in that day, okay? I went to the Jewish Encyclopedia and I found this quote. The dignity of, and I'm quoting now, the dignity, and this comes from ancient writings, ancient Jewish writings. The dignity of a teacher must not be lowered by greeting him or by answering his greeting in the ordinary manner. You just can't say, hey. A teacher should be greeted with, peace to thee, my master. Memorize this. This is how I expect to be greeted after this. His greeting should be answered by, peace be with thee, my master and teacher. So this was the thing. They literally taught their people, if you're going to greet me in the marketplace, this is how I have to be greeted. You have to maintain my dignity. And then in the second place, they wanted to be first. And again, Jesus gave two examples here. Let me translate the last part of verse 46 very literally. They love the first seats in the synagogues and the first places at the feasts. They loved to be first. Today, we would say they want to have, you know, they want to have seats on the platform even if they're not preaching, you know? So they're up here. They got first place, and we already talked about first place at feasts, you know. The places of honor were at the host's right hand and at the host's left hand. And those were the places they wanted. They were status seekers. Now, Jesus' point here in these first four examples is that we should beware of teachers and preachers who are addicted to popular applause, who are addicted to status. That's an indication of the fear of man. It's an indication that the fear of man is greater in that man's heart than the fear of God. And you get a man who is in a pulpit ministry, who's in a teaching ministry, and he cares more for the applause of men than he does for the approbation of God, and you will find that he's willing to trim his message to keep on pleasing men and gaining their applause. And my friends, this is what's happening today, even in evangelical circles at times. Beware of preachers, of teachers that are addicted to the applause of men. And then Jesus made an accusation against the scribes here that's one of the most radical in all of the Gospels. He said they devoured widows' houses. Now what was Jesus talking about? Again, if you go back into the Jewish religious writings from that time, there are two possibilities here. In some cases, the scribes were appointed as trustees to manage the estates of widows. And even as trustees can do today when there's not proper oversight, they can charge huge fees for their services, or they can find other ways to siphon off funds for their own purposes. I believe that's probably what was going on, what Jesus was talking about. A second possibility is that the scribes were taking advantage of the hospitality of these widows. One famous rabbi in his writings accused certain scribes of being gluttons by taking advantage of the hospitality of widows. Whatever the case, Jesus pointed here to a willingness to leverage a ministry position in order to gain personal profit. I'm reminded of the words of Peter in 1 Peter 5. He there exhorts elders to serve not for dishonest gain, but eagerly Now, I got to tell you, in our independent circles, if you become a pastor for personal gain, you're a nut. But there are pastors in some of these huge evangelical churches where this is a temptation to profit from the ministry. I've read of men in those positions who have guys ghostwrite books so they can put them out under their name and make big bucks that way. And this is a thing. Beware of any preacher, any pastor who's trying to make a profit from the flock. We find this not just here in the New Testament. You find it in the Old Testament as well. This is something that God hated. And then Jesus leveled one final accusation against the practices of the scribes. He said, "For a pretense they make long prayers." By how long they prayed in public, they wanted to demonstrate for everybody to see just how holy they were. And Jesus' words here indicated that their prayers were not from the heart. They were for show. They were the worst form of hypocrisy. The word hypocrisy means when our what comes out of our mouth does not match what's really in our heart. And Jesus is saying here that the prayers of these men did not really reveal what was in their heart. What was in their heart was a profit motive, status seeking, that kind of thing. So again, Jesus seemed to define these scribes as men pleasers who were motivated by a desire for men to think well of them. Even their prayers had that motivation. And again, preachers and pastors and teachers must be inoculated against that disease. Now, before we go on, step back for a minute, and I want you to put two and two together. These scribes were men pleasers. They wanted the Jewish public to recognize their education and to maintain their dignity. Can you imagine how these men felt when Jesus put this conundrum of Psalm 110 before them and they had not one word to answer? Jesus publicly took a pin from Psalm 110 and he stuck it in their inflated egos, and everyone watched their egos deflate. Can you imagine what they felt like? Is it any wonder that just a day or two later, they were part of the Sanhedrin who called for Jesus' crucifixion? I almost wonder if Jesus did not purposely do this to ensure that he would fulfill the prophecies of the Old Testament and be crucified for our sins. Then Jesus closed this warning against the scribes with these words: "These will receive greater condemnation." Jesus applied a principle to the scribes that we have already seen here in the book of Luke, back in chapter 12. I'm going to read a couple of verses to you. You'll remember them. "And that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself to do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know, yet committed things deserving of stripes, shall be beaten with few. For to whom much is given, from him much will be required. And to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more." Now the scribes fell into that first category. They knew the master's will, but they did not do according to his will. Much had been entrusted to them. Much had been committed to them. They were the teachers in Israel. They understood the Word of God, and yet they rejected its truth, and therefore they would suffer greater judgment in eternity. You've heard me preach this before, but I think I need to reiterate it again. We often make the mistake of thinking that it is the Attilas the Hun and the Genghis's the Khan and the Hitlers and the Stalins who are going to be in the lowest levels of hell. That's not what Scripture says. This is the scary part. Those who will suffer greater judgment in eternity are sitting in good churches this morning. I'll take it another step. Those who will suffer greater condemnation eternally are standing in pulpits this morning. In James 3:1, there is a verse that is constantly on my mind as I prepare messages and as I preach them. It says, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment." And that's precisely the principle that Jesus was applying to these scribes. They sat in the seat of Moses. They taught the people, and therefore they would be judged by God on a stricter basis. And because of their hypocrisy and their rapacity and their fear of man and ultimately their rejection of Jesus the Messiah, they would receive greater condemnation. But I'm always fearful. You young people who grow up under the teaching of God's Word, you have so much more committed to you. And therefore, God expects more of you. Well, we come to the end of chapter 20, and as I indicated when I read the text, the chapter should not have closed here. It should have included the next four verses. If you look at Luke 21, beginning with verse 5, all the way to the last verse of the chapter concerns one thing. It concerns the end times. It concerns the end of the age, eschatology. It's all about one thing except these first four verses. And that's because these first four verses in Luke 21 belong with Luke 20. What's described in these first four verses of chapter 1, I believe, took place immediately after Jesus got through with this warning about the scribes. I think he was warning his disciples, and then he just took a step and looked, and there they were, giving at the treasury. And he saw this perfect contrast to the religion of these rabbis, the religion of these scribes, in that poor widow woman. Now, the vignette that's painted in these four verses has been the basis for many a sermon. I thought about just preaching on these four verses today, but I'm just going to make four points. But if you've had your hearing aid off up till now because you weren't that interested in the scribes, turn your hearing aid back on because you need to hear what Jesus said about this widow woman. First, Jesus noticed who was giving and what they were giving. Jesus noticed who was giving and what they were giving. He looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw also a certain poor widow putting in two mites. Aren't those words suggestive? Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that in the forecourt of the temple, there were 13 receptacles for receiving free will offerings that went to support the temple and its services. And each of them was shaped like a trumpet. And apparently where Jesus and the disciples were standing, they were within eyeshot of one of these receptacles. Now, the purpose of these receptacles were a bit like our offering box back here. Although, I'm glad we don't make you drop it into a trumpet. But here's my point. The Lord notices when you and I are at that offering box. He noticed then, and He does not change, and He notices now. You know, I have to tell you that there have been a couple of times when the elders of this church have debated seriously whether we ought to pass the plate like most other churches do. Take our offering that way. There are advantages to that. It's very obviously a part of worship when you pass the plate in the worship service. It makes it more obvious that you ought to worship as you give. The downside to passing the plate is that it makes giving more public. And so people feel the pressure to give just for the sake of people seeing them give. And one of the reasons that we have continued to use the offering box here at Midway Bible Church is that we don't want people to feel that pressure. We don't want people to feel pressured into giving out of false motives. But I got to tell you, there are downsides to the offering box. Now, I like the offering box because it's very private. It's more private, obviously, than passing the plate. But here's the problem with that offering box. It's easy for us to put our offering in that offering box in a very thoughtless and offhand way. To put our offering in there with no more thought than we put an envelope in a post office box. Listen, the next time you're at the offering box, remember this text. Jesus saw this woman at the offering treasury, and he sees us now when we're at that offering box. And He doesn't just see what we give, He sees what's in our hearts. And if we give without a heart of worship, without lifting that offering consciously as a matter of our love to Him and our gratitude to Him, then we're shortchanging ourselves. And I'm preaching to myself because I don't even use the offering box. My bank sends my offering in every week. You want to talk about something that you do without any thinking? And that's why we have an offertory prayer in our service. It's so that if we don't do this at any other time, I hope when Pastor John is praying that prayer, you are lifting your heart to the Lord and saying, Lord, I give to You because I love You. I give to You because I worship You. I give to You because I want everyone to know about what You've done. Jesus saw, and He sees. We need to remember that. And then in my second point here, I'm reading between the lines. You know how I like to do that. I think Jesus noticed how they gave. Now, stick with me here. Use a little bit of sanctified imagination. Have you ever seen in any museum ancient paper money? You have. Where? Okay, because that's extremely unusual. First of all, paper was unusual. But paper money, they just didn't use paper money. What did they use? And they certainly didn't have checks, okay? I mean, they just didn't have checking accounts back then. There was nothing like that. So everybody gave with coins, okay? So stick with me here. When the rich people come with a pocket full of big coins and they throw them into that trumpet, what happens? Clang, 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 clang! Do you get it? Now, this is a thing. In fact, I think this is what Jesus was talking about in Matthew chapter 6. I want you to keep your finger here in Luke 21. I want you to turn with me back to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 2. Jesus says, therefore, when you do a charitable deed, and the word there is give alms, okay? So when you give to the poor, and they had these receptacles for that purpose as well, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. Now, can you imagine anybody literally doing what Jesus says here? Ba-ba-da-ba! He's about to give. We have no record that actually ever happened. But I have to wonder if what Jesus was talking about here in Matthew chapter 6 was what happened at these receptacles in the temple. When people came by and, man, they could... And can you imagine if you tried to make some sound? I have to wonder even if this is what the Apostle Paul was talking about in 1 Corinthians 13 when he talked about clanging cymbals. I mean, you could really make that ring, man. In contrast to the sounds of these rich donations, imagine the sound made by two mites. Now, mites were called lepta in ancient times. They were tiny copper coins, about the third of the size of one of our pennies. Teeny. In terms of our money today, they would have been worth about half a dollar. You say, wow, half a dollar. Yeah, that sounds like a lot, but think about what you can buy for half a dollar. For two mites, she might have been able to get a cup of coffee at McDonald's, but she wouldn't have been able to pay the tax. Certainly would not have been able to get a cup of coffee at Starbucks. But my point here is that her tiny donation would have just breezed right down that trumpet and made hardly a sound. I mean, even if she was trying to make some noise, and if you were giving two mites, would you be trying to make any noise? But according to Matthew 6, it's when we give in secret that God will reward us openly. We ought to do our best to make sure that one hand does not know what the other hand is doing when we give. That's what Jesus says here in Matthew 6. And so we have good reason for the offering box. We want you to be able to give in secret as much as possible. How we give, I think, is also important to the Lord. And then what Jesus really emphasizes here in the third place in this passage is that God sees our giving and He evaluates our giving based not on how much we give, but how much we keep. Let me repeat that. God evaluates our giving not based on what we give, but on what we keep. Jesus said that the rich gave out of their abundance, and after they gave big gifts, they still had abundance. The widow woman gave the little that she had out of her poverty, and when she had given, she had nothing. And that is why Jesus took notice of her gift. Now, you and I need to add this factor to the equation of our giving. I know that many of us here at Midway Bible Church are committed to tithing our income. We believe that the Bible teaches that at minimum, a believer ought to give 10% of his gross income off the top. We practice tithing in recognition that we are stewards, that everything, 100% of what we own belongs to the Lord. He has just entrusted it to us. And our tithing is a way of demonstrating to the Lord that we acknowledge that stewardship. All of that is right, I believe, and it's biblical. And I encourage every believer to tithe. But it's easy to tithe and then be very self-satisfied that I've done everything that God wanted me to do. Look at me. And Jesus here sticks a pin in that. Many of us are like the rich that Jesus saw that day, not in the sense that we were doing this for people to see us, but simply that we're doing this and we have abundance left. Notice, Jesus did not condemn the rich people for their giving. This is not a condemnation of that. You don't find that here. Rather, Jesus teaches us here how God evaluates all giving. And He evaluates all giving in terms of what we keep for our own use. We need to be careful to understand that we can tithe and yet not be doing enough in God's sight, because He evaluates what we have left after we give. In this matter of giving, I think we often get a hold of the wrong end of the stick. We think, look how much I've given, and God thinks, look how much you've kept. This came home to me as I studied this passage this week against the backdrop of those million people that I heard about in India, whose homes were destroyed. That email that I told you about was an appeal for giving. And I gave. But I never looked at what I had left. It's a sobering thing, isn't it? How much we as American Christians have left, even if we give. We need to understand that is the equation that God uses when He evaluates how we give. And then there's a final truth that flows out of this story. To some degree, it extends the point that I just made. And it provides the real contrast between the scribes and this widow woman. And that was her willingness to sacrifice for the purposes of God. Jesus said here at the end of verse 4 that she put in all the livelihood that she had. Now, I think it is really almost impossible for us as middle-class Americans to put ourselves in her sandals. I mean, I can easily imagine coming here to church and taking every bit of money that I've got in my wallet and every bit of money that I've got in my pocket and putting it in that offering box back there. But you know, after I do that, big deal. I've still got all kinds of money in a checking account and a savings account, and I got full cupboards back home. I don't think any of us can imagine putting in your last dollar. That's the equivalent here. Putting your last dollar in the offering box and literally having nothing left. It puts me in memory of another widow that's mentioned in the Bible, the widow that fed Elijah. You remember the story? 1 Kings 17 tells the story of Elijah and the famine. And when the famine got really bad, God sent Elijah to a widow woman in Zarephath. And Elijah met the widow at the gate of the city, and he asked her for a drink, and she got him a drink. And then he asked her for something to eat. You remember what she said? As the Lord your God lives, I do not have bread. Only a handful of flour in a bin and a little oil in a jar. And see, I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. It seems to me that the widow that Luke describes in Luke 21 was in no different situation. She was going to put those last two mites, she was going to put her last dollar in the offering and then go home and die. That's essentially what Jesus says. What a contrast to those scribes who were willing to cheat widow women like them to keep themselves in fine clothing and in the best of society. But here's my point. Jesus noticed that self-sacrifice then, and he notices that kind of sacrifice today. Now, I have to say that by and large, American Christians, American evangelicals are very short on self-sacrifice today. We love to talk about God's grace, and how you cannot exhaust God's giving and His mercy and His faithfulness, but sacrifice, don't sign me up. You know, I'm in higher education, and from the articles I read, from conversations that I have from time to time with educational leaders around the country, evangelical seminaries are struggling. And I'm not talking about one or two. In general, they are struggling. In just about every one of them, their enrollment is down. Why? Well, it's obvious. You got fewer men going into the pastoral ministry. Fewer men going to the mission field. Again, why? Well, there may be a whole lot of reasons, but at least one of those reasons is that fewer and fewer men are willing to sacrifice. They're just not willing to volunteer to undertake the sacrifice that it means going into the ministry or going to the mission field today. Fifty years ago, message after message after message would emphasize sacrificing for Christ. We don't hear it today. It's unheard of. It's almost as unpopular as preaching on hell. But Jesus expects sacrifice from those who follow Him. Take up your cross and follow me, He said. He noticed the widow's sacrifice then, and He notices our sacrifice today. But even as I speak of sacrifice, and I emphasize that This is what we're called to. This is part of the package deal. Let me remind you that no one can outgive the Lord. You know, when God calls on us to sacrifice, you can't outgive the Lord. J.C. Ryle, in his comments on this passage, asks this question. Let us look round the world and ask, where are the men that were ever ruined by liberal giving to godly purposes? Yeah, I gave so much to God, it just ruined my life. You ever heard that testimony? After all, that widow's bin of flour and the jar of oil were never exhausted as long as she sacrificed to support Elijah. Proverbs 11:24 puts it in these words, there is one who scatters yet increases more. There is one who withholds more than is right, but it leads to poverty. You can't outgive God. Well, as I close, I trust you've learned from this contrast. It's easy to pretend to be spiritual. There have always been hypocrites in the church. There always will be hypocrites in the church. Jesus noticed those hypocrites then. He notices them today. But I want you also to understand that Jesus also notices someone like this widow woman in the church. And there have been hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of individuals in the church down through the centuries like this widow woman who were willing to sacrifice all for God and His kingdom. Jesus observed that widow and He shared His observations with us. What do His observations teach you about you? What do His observations teach me about me? And how do we need to respond to what Jesus teaches us?